from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, the world economy is slowly recovering from the subprime mortgage debacle that laid the foundation for a housing bubble that cost investors and taxpayers more than $1 trillion. In his latest book, The Big Short, author Michael Lewis introduces us to a motley collection of investors and analysts who saw the calamity coming and got rich betting against the complicated financial instruments that made the collapse possible. Michael Lewis joins us this hour, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this week for Michael Krasny. Well, looking back at the economic crash of 2008, it seems obvious now what happened. It began with banks selling homes to millions of Americans who couldn't really afford them, enticing them with subprime mortgages they could only afford by using equity in their home for the monthly payment. Well, you know the rest of the story: home foreclosures, a stock market crash, and a government bailout of banks, AIG, and other investment companies. It still makes us furious every time we hear about big bonuses being paid out to some of the people who ran those companies. And although it may seem obvious now, very few saw it coming. In his new book, The Big Short, Michael Lewis introduces us to some folks who not only saw it coming, but doubled down by betting against it, making billions in the process. And Michael Lewis joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Well, at its root, is this a story of greed, or is it really much more complicated than that?
Well, it's much more complicated than that. I mean, every story on Wall Street is a story of greed, but greed doesn't always wreak such havoc. I mean, look, anybody who goes to work on Wall Street has got a little greed in them. You don't go to work on Wall Street if you're not interested in money.
And you went to Wall Street.
I worked on Wall Street. Yes, I have a little greed in me too. The problem is the way the greed was channeled. I mean, the rules, the system of incentives on Wall Street got so screwed up that the greed was channeled into very destructive ends.
Well, and is often the case in capitalism, there was a very little long-term perspective. It was all short-term. What kind of cash can I get today or this week without real concern for the future?
But that's a contemporary phenomenon. We lost perspective on that. I mean, this is the sort of insistent short-termism that governs the behavior of both the individual traders taking the risk and the firms making their bigger judgments about what to do with themselves. This is a product of changes that have happened in the financial system over the last 25, 30 years, and changes that you could have predicted would have this effect. But I mean, for example, when I worked on Wall Street back in the mid-late 80s, I was working at a firm.
You worked at Salomon Brothers.
I worked at Salomon Brothers, wrote a book about it called Liar's Poker. But I worked at a firm that had been, until very recently, a partnership. And had just recently transformed itself into a public corporation, and it was the first of the big firms to do this, and then everybody quickly followed suit. And the minute the firms changed from partnerships to corporations, their interests changed.
Because of the shareholders?
Well, it was no longer the money that was being speculated with or invested, the fate of the firm was the fate of the partners. That their wealth was completely tied up in the firm. They had personal liability for what the firm did. The minute they got cashed out and they became public corporations, all of a sudden they're playing with shareholders' money, and it's a different thing. It's a different level of oversight, different interests, and I think it's fair to say that no private partnership would have been sitting on $50 billion of subprime-backed CDOs like Merrill Lynch and Citigroup were. I mean, it's unthinkable. The kind of risks that the firms were running, 30, 35 to 1 leverage, you know, a dollar of capital for every $30 of bets, no partnership. That's insane. And it only makes sense if the losses are in some sense taken care of by someone else.
You know, you point out in the book that these subprime mortgages were around in the 1990s, but they were fixed rate, unlike the 2-year fixed, and then they were
they weren't
adjusted.
All fixed rate. Yeah, no, this is there's a backstory which I deal with very briefly, but there was a brief flurry of activity in the subprime mortgage lending market in the mid late 90s, and the loans were generally as different looking than the loans that got made in the mid 2000s. They were more likely to be fixed rate. I can't remember the exact numbers, but say 60% of them were fixed rate, genuinely fixed rate mortgages, 30-year fixed rate mortgages.
How do you ever pay that off?
Well, you pay back principal.
It's a normal mortgage.
It's like And the reason for this is that it is generally assumed that people of limited means, who are on the other end of the subprime loans, people who are borrowing the money, shouldn't be exposed to sharply increasing interest rates. Their interest rates should be locked in.
In other words, they were being responsible.
Or the lenders were forcing them to be responsible.
Right.
Right. What happened in the second iteration of the subprime lending in the subprime lending market? So that market exists for three or four, five years in the 90s, generates at most a few tens of billions of dollars of loans a year, collapses for a number of reasons, but it's not that big a deal. I mean, it never gets to be that big a market. When it comes back, when it's reborn, starting kind of 2003, 2004, then really roaring in 2005 and 2006, it's reborn with a different structure. One of the big changes is the people who make the loans, the mortgage originators, don't have to keep any of the loans or aren't keeping the loans on their books, so that they have absolutely no interest in whether the borrower repays his loan or not. They're out. They're taking a fee on the transaction. And there are actually several intermediaries along the way who do the same thing before the loan gets to the ultimate lender.
Sort of like musical chairs.
Yes. But then the second thing that happens is that the structure, well, not there, it's related. The structure of the loans change. They become almost exclusively floating rate loans with these teaser rates. So that I go to you, Scott, and I say, you don't have any money and I probably shouldn't lend it to you, but there's this house you can buy and it's probably going to go up in value. You can't afford what the actual market interest rate is on this loan. So we're going to give you a loan with, a 5 or 4% interest rate, maybe even lower. And it'll last for 2 years, and 2 years from now, it's going to kick up to whatever the floating market rate is. It might go kick up to 9, 10, 11%. But it won't matter to you because we can refinance you before then. That the loans were designed to be refinanced. And from the point of view of the lender, it was wonderful business because you had a built-in repeat customers. When I made a loan to you, it wasn't a 30-year loan, even though it was a stated 30-year loan. It was assumed I was going to roll you out of that in 2 years.
Well, and in some cases, they couldn't even afford the short-term payments, and they were using sort of the value in the house, the equity, to help pay for that or pay for other things anyway.
Well, yes. I mean, the story I've told is about people who were sort of anticipating the crisis, who saw it coming. And the person who's really the first one to put his finger on is a fellow named Michael Burry, who's a hedge fund manager in San Jose.
Formerly a Stanford neurosurgeon,
listening to this this broadcast. But what Michael Burry notices is just this. I mean, it's an odd thing for him to notice because he's a value stock market investor. His job is meant to be picking stocks, but he's found that this subprime lending has gotten so egregious that it's likely to affect his stock portfolio, so he starts to make a study of it. And what he sees is that these pools of mortgages that are underneath the subprime mortgage bonds have changed in their very nature, that they've gone from being fixed to floating rate, but in addition, they've gone from being not just floating rate to being what's called pay option loans, which is now not only am I lending you money with a teaser rate and on a floating rate of interest that's very risky, but it's interest only. You don't have to repay any of the principal, and it's pay option, which means you actually don't even have to repay the interest. That if you don't repay the interest, they just roll it into a higher principal balance. So what he sees is that he calls it the extension of credit by instrument, which means that they're devising new structures to the mortgages to get money to less and less creditworthy people. And he figures with this structure, it couldn't possibly get any worse. It actually hit bottom. Free money. You don't have to pay it back.
Built to fail.
Built to fail. And when he finds a pool of these loans, our mortgage bond supported entirely by a pool of these sorts of loans, is when he makes his first bet against the subprime mortgage market.
And he sort of came up with this credit default swap idea.
More complicated than that. The credit default swap is a financial innovation. It's an insurance policy on a security. So, I mean, it's people who aren't in the financial world find this mind-blowing. So I think we need to stop and sort of explain it rather than gloss over it. But it's if you see this bond in the world, I mean, the subprime mortgage bond, and you think it's going to go down, there's only one way to bet against it.
And by go down, you mean?
Go down in price. Like, the loans aren't going to be repaid. It's going to be a valueless bond. And you wanted to make the bet against it, what you would do is buy a credit default swap on that bond. And you're buying an insurance policy on that bond. And you will pay a couple of percent in premium a year to the person who sells you the insurance policy. And if you're right and the bond defaults, you get paid 100. That's the bet. And Michael Burry understands that credit default swaps exist elsewhere in the financial world, but they have yet to be invented for subprime mortgage bonds. And he starts to push Wall Street firms to create these instruments because he knows they're going to do it anyway. He just wants to be in on the ground
floor. Get a good price.
And also wants to help design the documents. So, you know, he wants them to be investor friendly.
So it's in a way, it's like buying fire insurance on a house where you know everyone in the house is a pyromaniac. And it's just a matter of time before the house burns down.
Well, yes. It's like being able to buy fire insurance on someone else's house. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And there are a number of characters in the book, Michael Burry being one of the stars, I guess, and a lot of them are characters. I mean, he's blind in one eye. He was a neurosurgeon, the chief of neurosurgery, I think.
He was a resident.
He was a resident.
But you know what? As the story, as I'm out here on book tour, we can promote him. Yes.
Inflation.
By the end, he'll be, yes.
Where did I thought for sure I read that.
He'll be the Surgeon General by the time we're done.
So I'm not sure that would be a promotion.
Look, they're all characters. The reason I wrote this story was not to write an editorial about Wall Street. This is a wonderful, wonderful narrative driven by these characters that I couldn't believe existed. I couldn't believe that what I couldn't believe was that, first, you've got to just basically understand that the entire financial system, starting kind of 2005, organized itself around this single bet. Most of the financial system, all the big firms, were betting on subprime mortgage bonds. A very small handful of investors saw that this was catastrophic and took a bet against it. And you're talking about 10 to 20 people who did it in a big way, small. And those people ended up being wonderful characters, maybe not surprisingly, right? They're operating in – and so he was the first of the wonderful characters.
And this is, as you point out, a zero-sum game. Everyone can't win. I mean, can as many people as wanted to have bought these credit default swaps on a single bond, or was there a limit?
It would have been you couldn't have, if you were just an individual investor. It would have been very, very, very hard to get a Wall Street firm to do business with you because they're exposed to your credit when they do this. So you would have to have been an institution that was allowed to sell short, to bet against prices. So that means any hedge fund could – a lot of firms could have. Tens of thousands of institutional investors could have made the bet. And it is exactly a zero-sum bet. You lose – if we do a credit default swap between us, a dollar out of my pocket is a dollar in your pocket and vice versa. So here you have this guy who is in his early 30s. He's a former Stanford neurologist. He's a resident in neurology. So he's a doctor. He is hyper-energetic and very focused. So while he's a resident at Stanford, he is blogging about value investing. I mean, where people find time to blog about value investing when they're doing their residency in medicine, that's another question. And he's doing it in the late 90s when there aren't even a thing called a blog. It is a blog, but nobody calls it a blog. And he's just – it's just almost for himself. And it gets – a crowd starts to form. And the crowd starts to contain people like – subsidiaries of insurance companies owned by Warren Buffett and big Wall Street firms. He's really good.
He had a track record.
He had a track record, and people couldn't believe how smart he was on the subject. And so one day he posts on his blog, closed for business. I'm quitting medicine and I'm going to go be a, I'm going to be an investor. He didn't have any money. He had $100,000 or $150,000 in student loans he had to pay off. And it was very grandiose. He went and tried to dun his mother and brothers for money and they gave him a few bucks, but didn't have any money either. And out of nowhere come two major East Coast investors, one of this place owned by Warren Buffett called White Mountains and another very well-known investor in New York called Gotham Capital. And they give him millions of dollars to start because they've been following what he's been writing on the web. And they've never done anything like this before. And so this gives him his start. What he doesn't know, what Michael Burry, what makes him a particularly kind of peculiar character is that he has Asperger's syndrome and doesn't know it. That he is a medical doctor who has misdiagnosed himself but is diagnosing the world around him very acutely. And this gives him an advantage. I mean, one of the questions is, look, if there's so few people who are on the right side of this bed, why? What is it about them that enabled them to do this? And the Asperger's was central to it.
Hmm. One of the fundamental questions in all this is, why do people like Michael Burry and some of the other characters in your book, Steve Eisman and Greg Lipman, why is it that they figured it out and yet the rating agencies didn't figure it out? All these smart people whose job it was really to protect consumers in a way or to at least evaluate these pools of money, why did they miss it?
Well, the easy answer to that is that the financial system, entire financial system, was paid to miss it. When you're paid lots of money not to see something, it's amazing how good you'll get at not seeing something.
What do you mean, paid not to see something?
Well, let's start with the ratings agencies. Moody's and Standard & Poor are paid by Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank and all the rest to rate the bonds that Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs and all the rest create. So right there, you have an incentive not to notice bad things in the bonds because you're getting paid by the person who's creating the bonds.
It's like Arthur Andersen and Enron in a sense.
But there was what happened in the subprime mortgage lending market was so big that it became very quickly about half the profits of the ratings agencies. If they had shut it down, they'd have shut down half their business. So what I mean is that this story, among other things, is, I think, a story about perception, about why people see what they see. And so the simple answer on the one hand is a lot of people were paid not to see the truth, and they didn't see the truth. But the complicated answer on the other hand is the handful of people who did see the truth, because it's not obvious in the beginning that they're being paid to see the truth, and it causes them no end of grief that they're on the other side of the financial system for some time.
And grief from whom?
Michael Burry, let's take him as an example. He's meant to be picking stocks. He is being funded by some of the highest status, highest profile money people in America. When he goes off the reservation and says, I'm not going to be picking stocks anymore, I'm going to be betting on the collapse of the financial system, basically, they rebel. They all want their money back. If they get their money back, he can't keep his bet. So he invokes a clause in his documents that enable him to say, you can't have your money back. I'm keeping my bet until it either pays off or doesn't pay off. This makes him a pariah in the investment community. He ruins his reputation for the sake of the bet. His employees rebel. His employees are not universally on board with his vision about what's going on. He is already an isolated person because the Asperger's is one of the symptoms, one of the consequences of Asperger's is you very often very socially uncomfortable. And he has a glass eye too, which doesn't help. You know, he's uncomfortable in face-to-face interactions, and so he's already isolated in a dark room. You know, reading financial filings all the time, and he becomes even more so. And the interesting thing to me is that here you have this story that is, in some ways, a wonderful story. He sees the truth. He bets on the truth. He defies all the people around him to maintain his bet on the truth. It pays off. Everybody gets rich. Except they all hate each other. And Michael Burry decides he doesn't want to ever run anybody's money ever again.
They still hate each other?
Yes. They're still very angry with each other. Hmm. So it's a curious story.
Our guest this hour, Michael Lewis. His latest book is called The Big Short: Inside the Doomsday Machine. It's all about people who made off like bandits, in a sense, in the financial meltdown, which other people lost so much money over. Why is it that we talked about the rating houses and how they were getting a lot of money from sort of overlooking things? But what about companies like, you know, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley? They were buying these bonds or selling. You know,
they were buying loans, turning them into bonds
that they should have known were risky.
I mean, well, from their point of view, if you're Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley and you're buying. And Wells Fargo, by the way, was relatively responsible. They were on the very, very responsible wing of things. We out here can be proud of Wells Fargo,
and they're still standing.
Yes, and they're still standing. But these firms buy pools of loans, and they're going to package them into bonds. And as long as they can get the rating they know they need to get from the ratings agencies, there's not much risk involved. I mean, the investors are standing on the other side. So the question is, why do they abdicate their responsibility to evaluate the loans under the bonds? And they would say it wasn't our responsibility. It's the responsibility of the people who are the ultimate investors.
But as you point out, the bond market is opaque. It's not as transparent as the equity market.
Well, this is just generally, you know, one way to describe what just happened on Wall Street. That I don't see it often described this way, is it is a bond market event. This wasn't the stock market that went haywire. The bond market has peculiar problems. Compared to the stock market, it is the Wild West. The stock market has been on the receiving end of lots of political pressure, populist political pressure, for a long time, because there are lots of small investors in the stock market. And as ineptly as it's done, there is still a real attempt to protect the little guy in the stock market. And the stock market is very transparent. You buy a share of something, you can see the price trade on the screen. It's much, much harder to rip someone off in the stock market than it is the bond market. The bond market is designed to rip off the customers. It is many of the securities don't trade on screens. They trade by appointment, and you know they're worth whatever the guy at Goldman Sachs says they're worth. Many of them are very complicated securities. The complexity is an advantage to the Wall Street firm because they can use it against the customer. They understand it, and the customer doesn't. And the curious thing is the ethic in the bond market, because it's largely institutional investors, big pension funds, big insurance companies, so on and so forth. It's sort of assumed that we're all big boys here. So,
There's
no crying in the bond market.
You know, when you look at, say, a pension fund like CalPERS, you know, and they bought a lot of these mortgage packages, I guess, and lost billions, I'm sure, right? Was that just part of diversification?
Like CalPERS is suing the ratings agencies. Yes, and from the point of view of CalPERS or any other big fund that's buying AAA rated bonds backed by subprime mortgages, they probably think of it this way: it is diversification a bit more, you know, being in the mortgage markets as opposed to having AAA corporate bonds. But it's AAA, and the problem with the once the bonds are rubber stamped by Moody's and S&P AAA, the game's over, because investors are paid so little to hold AAA rated securities. This is the rating that the U.S. Treasury receives. It's the lowest yielding securities. So you're talking about fractions of a percentage point to hold massive quantities of this stuff. And they don't have the manpower. It doesn't pay anybody to go back and reverse engineer the bonds and figure out what's underneath them. It's almost built into the structure of the market that if it's got a AAA rating, it will be taken on blind faith. That's probably not true now, but it certainly was true. And so these things, that was the secret was how much of these loans got packaged into bonds that we then called AAA.
All right. Much more to talk about with Michael Lewis. His latest book is called The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a comment on our website. Just visit kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this week and next for Michael Krasny. And my guest this hour is Michael Lewis. His new book is called The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine, all about some characters who foresaw the crash coming and made off with lots of money. The number to call if you want to ask Michael Lewis a question is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's go to the phones, and John is on the line in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thank you for your book, Michael. You talk about only a few people knowing what disastrous results were going to occur, but at the street level, with the real estate salesman and the buyer, didn't the real estate salesman know that the buyer was not going to be able to make good on the mortgage, and wasn't the real estate man guilty of fraud under those circumstances?
Let me just back up a little bit, because I don't think very few people knew or had a premonition. It was very few people made a bet. Lots of people, if you go back over the newspapers in 2003, 2004, there are all kinds of warnings. But the financial system did not respond to those in any way, except these handful of people who actually made a bet. So now down at the street level, look, I think that the answer to that question is no question. It varies from real estate lender to real estate lender. And that in some cases, I'm sure what happened amounted to fraud. But I would think more generally, the attitude was, we're making these loans to people who can't repay them, yes. But we're making these loans against assets that are rising in value and they're going to keep rising. So that will enable them to pay them off. So, and since everybody else is doing it, which is, it's not something I have to think about very much. I mean, this is the thing. One of the things that strikes me about this crisis is at every point in the chain that created the debacle, there was a story to tell oneself to exonerate oneself. I don't think there are a lot of people wandering around feeling guilty right now. Very few people see themselves as villains after the fact. And what worries me going forward is that the emphasis in the culture is going to be to find a handful of people who we can readily identify as villains and string them up, when I think the story I've told shows you it's much, much worse than that. There's systematic problems that need to be fixed. There's systematic problems about the way incentives are channeled in the financial system. The rules of the road need to change. Because I think most of what happened was actually legal.
Yeah. You say that there are very few people walking around feeling, I forget the word, was you guilty or, you know, responsible. But do they feel like they screwed up?
Well, it's very hard if you're running a big Wall Street firm not to be reminded every day that you screwed up. Do they actually feel that
way? What if
you
walked away with
big payouts? No, I think, in fact, this is one of the things that got me into this story. I started working on this 2 years ago. And I think the first thing that got that caught my attention was one, the big Wall Street firms had somehow become the dumb money at the poker table. I didn't understand how that had happened. But two, people whose firms were blowing up, like the head of Lehman Brothers and the head of Bear Stearns, they clearly already had a story they told themselves that sort of gave them an out. That they saw them, and the story was basically this: they saw themselves as victims. That this tsunami rolled over the financial system. And my house got wiped out, but nobody saw the tsunami coming. So how can you really blame me? No one saw it, and which is why I went to these characters, because these characters very clearly did see it. So you can see that actually that is not a very good excuse. It could have been seen.
Well, what about people like Michael Burry? He made off with how much money? Billions and billions.
No. For himself, look, by the time he was done, enough of his investors had managed to get their money back from him that he had a fund of about $550 million. On top, he made with that $550 from this bet another $750 million. And so not quite a billion.
Yeah.
And for him, if they'd let him do what he was trying to do, he would have made billions and billions. For himself, I think he made $100 million. Incredible sum of money. I mean, for someone who was 5 years before broke.
And this was mostly from these credit default swaps.
Entirely.
And who paid the money? Where did the money come from?
Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank and Citigroup and Bank of America and the people who sold them the insurance on subprime mortgage bonds.
And so ultimately...
But this is the great question. Who is ultimately on the other side? In some cases, them. In some cases, AIG, the insurance company that has now got $178 billion of taxpayer guarantee, who sold, because AIG had sold lots of credit default swaps, lots of insurance on subprime mortgage bonds, in some cases, and investors in the things in Germany or wherever. I mean, so there were – it's hard to know exactly who was on the other side, but broadly everybody.
What about taxpayers?
Well, if the taxpayer ends up paying for the if AIG ends up costing the taxpayer money, still not clear what's going to happen there. But yes, absolutely, the taxpayer.
And so does he, of course, he's sort of antisocial.
In the process, what I ask him is, does he feel guilty?
Yeah.
Does he feel bad?
Or responsible?
I tell you what he felt. He gave me all his emails from this period, from 03 to 08, so I could see what was going through his head in real time. It's very easy to say you feel badly after the fact. In real time, he was writing emails about how morbid it was for someone who basically was put on earth to find value in companies to have been twisted by the financial system, by what was going on, into this person who was betting on its collapse. But he felt, look, his job is to be intelligent with other people's money. He's managing other people's money. And it was the only intelligent thing to do. So in a narrow sense, he behaves very responsibly. In a narrow sense, in a broader sense, if everybody had thought the way he thought, the crisis wouldn't have happened. However, he does feel a little odd about how he made his fortune. He doesn't feel really warm and fuzzy about it.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. John is online in San Francisco. Welcome.
Oh, hi. I'm on chapter 3, and I love the story, but I am outraged, and I think you've accomplished your goal with me for sure. But the deceit, I was curious about, you said it was legal what Goldman Sachs was doing. Wasn't there, once we bailed out AIG, wasn't there a lot of deceit that we can verify? And then isn't deceit fraud, and isn't Goldman Sachs liable, and should they be liable for all the bonuses of at least 2009?
Well, let me ask you, when you're saying where exactly are you pointing to? You point to the post bailout deceit or pre bailout deceit? Because there were two species.
Yeah, post bailout.
Post bailout. Okay, so after all the loans have been made and the bonds have been sold and all the rest, and it all comes a cropper, there does seem to have been. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't matter. It seemed to mean there was. Incredible obfuscation by the Fed, who was helping orchestrate the bailout of AIG, in the paying off of AIG's gambling debts. This is what they essentially were. There's this casino that's arisen on the side of Wall Street, and it's called the casino of credit default swaps. The AIG had sold lots of credit default swaps, and now they were wrong, and their debts had to be paid off, and they couldn't afford to pay them off. So the Treasury steps in and pays off AIG's gambling debts. And the question was, and the great question was, so they paid $13 billion to Goldman Sachs, 100 cents on the dollar. Question was, why did they pay those off without even trying to negotiate down Goldman Sachs? And they've been What's leaked into the press so far suggests that they knew that if they let people know what they were doing in real time, that there would have been a huge political backlash and they wouldn't have been able to do it. There was a kind of deceit practiced upon people by that. But I think that the people at the Fed and the Treasury thought they were doing it for the public good, because I think what they thought is that if they didn't pay off the gambling debts that AIG had incurred, all the financial institutions on the other side of those debts would have been weakened. The market wouldn't have believed they would have survived.
Too big to fail.
And they were afraid that all these firms were going to fail. But this is what I think is coming down the pike. There is a Financial Inquiry Commission with subpoena power run by Phil Angelides and is staffed up. And they're dragging in people every day and debriefing them.
Under oath?
Under oath, and they're going to have a report by the end of the year. I assume that is going to lead to hearings and problems for lots of people.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. You know, there have been understandably a clamor for regulation of the financial industry, and it sounds like you're saying that maybe they should wait until that report comes out at the end of the year.
Well, this is a curious thing. They're not waiting.
Chris Dodd
has already floated his bill, and My sense is that it goes right now that healthcare reform is done. The next thing is financial reform.
Be a lot more popular.
Yes, and it makes a lot of sense. I don't think there's any reason to wait. I think the sooner it's done, the better, because you've got these institutions that are just getting more powerful by the day. They need to be broken up. And either forcibly, or if the rules that are introduced are saying they will break themselves up.
But is that really what they're talking about, breaking them up?
It depends on who you talk to. The head of the Dallas Fed came out the other day and said they need to be broken up. Ben Bernanke more or less said it a couple of days ago. It's not in the Dodd bill, doesn't say we're going to break them all up. But if they do, if they, for example, ban proprietary trading in the firms, if they say to the firms, you can no longer bet your own money on securities that you're advising customers on, that conflict of interest is going to be eliminated. They'd break themselves up. They'd go off. Half of them would go be proprietary traders and half of them would go advise customers.
It seems, though, that no matter what you do, you regulate one thing and then it pops up in another way. I mean, is there really...
You don't feel like you can control your financial system from your seat right
no,
here?
No, I don't.
Right here at KQED?
I don't.
No, I don't know why you feel that way. Yes, there's reason to be cynical about Wall Street when given a set of rules, they seem to have an unbelievable ability to get around it. But there has been very useful financial regulation introduced in the past. Glass-Steagall worked. The problem recently has been the government's sins of omission rather than commission, not even trying to regulate. So, for example, credit default swaps are invented. They are insurance. Why on earth are they not regulated like insurance? It's insane that
they're still not regulated.
It's insane that you can have a neighborhood that's likely to be torched and that's worth $1 million, and that a casino with side bets of billions of dollars of fire insurance can grow up beside that neighborhood. That makes no sense. And so if there had been an attempt to regulate credit default swaps at the outset, this catastrophe would have been much less bad.
All right, so we're a year and a half or more out now, and mm-hmm. they're still not regulated?
No, nothing's happened.
Nothing's happened.
No, nothing's happened. So nothing's happened, but nothing's happened for. I mean, there is a reason nothing's happened. More than one reason. I mean, obviously, the Obama administration came in and had other things as priorities, and they made a tactical decision. They wanted to do health reform first. And I think they thought that if they tackle financial reform, that it was going to cost them, and it would make it harder, not easier to do.
Well, it might have been a lot harder to get it done.
Might have been. So it was just a decision they made. So, I mean, those are political reasons. But I think the financial reasons, if you talked – now I'm just channeling what, the Treasury Secretary might say to you, is he'd say we've got to deal with the symptoms before we can deal with the cause, that we've got these institutions – our first job is just prevent them from failing, and then we're going to figure out how to make sure they're never again too big to fail.
Yeah. So you think the bailout was the right thing to do?
No. I don't know. I don't know. I think it was horribly unjust. Look, this is what happened. The bad actors who created the problem, who made all those horrible loans, were the recipient of the help when the help came. If you just backed away from it and said, look, here's the problem in our financial system. This beast, big Wall Street firms, have become really bad at doing what they're supposed to do, which is making sensible loans. We now have a crisis. We've got a whole bunch of money, many billions of dollars we can give to banks to subsidize them so they can give some good loans. Why give it to the people who have been proven they can't? Why give them the guys who make bad loans? Go give it to, little community banks. I mean, just that way it made no sense to me. What I don't understand is to this day, no one has explained it to me, and I've talked to people in government. I don't understand why, instead of going to Congress and asking for $780 billion in TARP money or whatever it was to invest in these big firms, Hank Paulson couldn't go to Congress and say, I need very quickly the ability to essentially nationalize these firms and sell them off, to break them up. I need to be able to throw them into an orderly bankruptcy, not a chaotic bankruptcy, an orderly bankruptcy.
And Wall Street.
But you're giving me that's a political reason or a personal reason.
Well, this is all politics, though. I mean, in President, Bush was still president.
Yeah.
He's not going to nationalize the banks.
There are But the argument even now is there are practical impediments to doing this. And the American government took a quixotic view of all this. I mean, they did a very different thing, say, what the British government did. The American government took the view that these firms can't be nationalized and the creditors can't take any kind of hits. There can be no losses experienced by the creditors. And once you do that, you are painted into the corner. There is only one solution. You have to give money. You have to gift money to the banks until they're healthy. Now, I don't know whether that was right or not. I don't have with the, I'm not sitting here with the information they were working with, but it's highly suspicious. And if the end result of all that is that these institutions that have survived only because the taxpayer have gifted them money are now in a position to defeat legislation for their reform, that's disastrous. I would rather them all have gone down.
All right, back to the phones. Terry in Oakland, good morning.
Good morning. I just kind of want to piggyback a little bit on what you were saying with regard to bailing out the banks. I guess it was a year two ago, December of 2008, I guess, that Elizabeth Warren was on your show, and she was ordained the person to oversee the bailout panel. And her complaint at 2 weeks after the inception of the bailout was that that there were no guidelines or expectations of the for services to the public for the banks. There were no guidelines as to how and where the money should be used, and it wasn't clear whether the banks were selling actually acquiring stocks and investing overseas. So there was nothing to make sure that while they were being, the banks were being taken care of and bailed out, that they were also helping the people. And there were also no, there was no record, actually, of no forced guidelines to make sure that the banks provided records to the government to say exactly what they were doing.
And one of the things that was odd is that even after they got all this money, the bailout money, it was still very difficult for people to get loans, and still is to a certain extent.
So it's very, I'm with you there, it's very curious as to really what's kind of going on. I mean, how can you invite the big Wall Street bankers to the White House, have them fill out a page and a half loan document that entitles them to monstrous sums of money, and that's mostly white paper. There's a copy of it in one of the.
I want to give Michael Lewis a chance to respond because we're a little short on time. We've got a lot of people that want to talk.
I don't think there was a question there.
Is there a question?
You mean to answer? You mean
it sounds like you're saying there's a lack of transparency.
I'll answer the statement. I'll just let some air into the room. I think that what was happening around that time was actually of less. My book's not about it, really. It's not about it. It was less of interest to me than how they got themselves into the position in the first place. And I think it's just sort of not generally appreciated that people think of the financial crisis as that moment in the September, October, November, December of 2008, when in fact really the financial crisis was March 2005 to the end of 2007. That everything bad that happened, all the bad risk that was created, all the bad loans that were made and placed, it was all in place and immovable by the end of 2007. There was nothing left to prevent by the end of 2007. After that, it was sort of it was written that this was going to, that we were going to be, that the financial system was going to come down. It was just a question of how and who was going to be rescued and who wasn't going to be rescued. It is highly unsatisfying the way the government handled it, because the government is essentially taking the view this is all too complicated for people to understand. And I think that's a corrosive view. I'm not just sucking up to the public here. We've had a long period with Alan Greenspan as the chairman of the Fed, and whenever he spoke, nobody understood what the hell he was saying. And a long period where Wall Street people were sort of an unquestioned master class, generating increasingly complicated things that could not be explained to people. You can't run a society this way. where the financial world is regarded as this this little black box that people inside of it know what's going on. You're supposed to just trust them. You can't change public policy intelligently this way.
Why is it that it seems that Wall Street is still largely opposing regulation that's being proposed?
Because they
you think they want to be saved from themselves?
They've got the best of all possible worlds right now. All their losses are socialized, and they get to keep their gains.
Well, they think that'll happen again.
Happening now. That's the deal now. The deal now is if the bets work out, they keep a large part of the bets. Morgan Stanley paid itself 60% of its revenues to employees this year. I mean, it's incredible. Even public radio doesn't do that.
We don't have any profit.
But if Morgan Stanley goes down tomorrow, it's your problem.
Yeah. All right. Email from Annie. She writes, since all this terrible meltdown was so covert and impossible to understand or see, how did Michael Lewis find out about it? How did you do your research?
Well, I worked on Wall Street. That helped. You know, it helped that I'd been there also when the sort of the complicated stuff just started happening. So I had a bit of a grounding in that. But the way it started for me was there was a female analyst at a firm called Oppenheimer. Her name's Meredith Whitney. And Meredith Whitney, kind of towards the end of 07, summer, fall of 07, she starts writing reports about the Wall Street firms that are actually condescending in tone. She's a Wall Street analyst condescending to Wall Street firms and basically saying, these firms I'm covering do not understand their own businesses. And I'd never seen anybody on Wall Street do that to someone else on Wall Street. And I called her up and I used her as a sounding board as the crisis unfolded. And when she sort of explained to me that the big Wall Street firms had become dangerous because they'd become idiotic, sort of numb to their own long-term interests, there was a natural question. And the question was, well, if they're the dumb money, it's always a poker game. There's always a large zero-sum component to what's going on Wall Street. They used to be the smart money at the table, and everybody else was the dumb money. If they're the dumb money, where'd the smart money go? And this led me to these three characters. And when I don't write books as editorials. Books for me, these stories are almost data. You know, you write what happened, and the reader will fill in what they think. These characters and these stories were so compelling, and that's why I wrote. That's how I got rope back into this.
And one of the characters is this guy, Greg Lippman, who works for Deutsche Bank. And
he's the most curious of all characters.
He is screaming at the top of his lungs about how crazy all this is, even as he's helping people like Michael Burry buy these credit default swaps.
Think about this character. This is a literary character, Greg Lippman. Greg Lippman is the head subprime mortgage bond trader at Deutsche Bank. He's American. Deutsche Bank is functions much like an American investment bank. And Greg Lippman, after Michael Burry, comes to the conclusion, through some very careful analysis, that the subprime mortgage bond market is actually really ridiculous and that it's the smart bet is the bet against it. But he's inside the machine that's creating the problem. So everywhere else in Deutsche Bank, they are promoting subprime mortgage bonds. It is a wave of propaganda by subprime mortgage stuff coming out of Deutsche Bank. And they have this one trader who's calling everybody a fool. And he's abrasive. His personality is abrasive. One of his friends said to me, I love Greg, but he's a whack job. You know, that he is an unreliable character. He behaves in ways that make people kind of wonder about him. And he's stuck all alone betting against this market, and he wants company. He figures if he can get other people to bet against it, he could kill it. And so,
why didn't he get fired?
He was made the firm too much money, but it's a great question. Why didn't he get fired? He made a lot of enemies, but he didn't get fired. And he runs around the world selling what is maybe the single best idea that a Wall Street firm has sold to its customers in the last century. I mean, it was just a get-rich-quick scheme. And because he comes from the bond market and because he is who he is, nobody believes him. They all sit there and they listen to the argument and say, yeah, the argument sounds right, but if you're on the other side of it, something must be wrong with it. And so over and over, he gets turned down. He really is at the center of the market, there is an unreliable narrator named Greg Lipman, and this is exactly what the market deserves as a literary solution, an unreliable narrator.
All right, another email here from Dirk, who writes, Goldman Sachs, according to your telling of the story, bet on subprime mortgages extensively, yet it's clear that in the aftermath of the crisis, they're amongst the institutions that most smells like a rose. How did this happen?
Well, Goldman Sachs was in a position, just the same position as the rest of the big Wall Street firms, through 2006 and into 2007. One way or another, they owned lots of subprime mortgage bonds. If the market had been collapsed when it was supposed to collapse, when a sane market would have collapsed maybe 18 months earlier, they would have lost a lot of money. But the Goldman is structured differently from, say, Deutsche Bank. There's no Greg Lipman inside Goldman Sachs. Everybody is sort of on the same page. If they have arguments, they take it into a room and they resolve it. It's beautifully run from this point of view. And the Goldman risk managers saw that they had this big risk. They heard people like Greg Lipman running around making his argument. And the people at the top of the firm got nervous about it. And they turned on a dime. And the question is when they turned on a dime. There have been reports out of Goldman's that lead people to believe that it was sort of the end of 06. I think it was much later. I think it was close to the summer of 07. But they end up going overnight from being an owner of subprime mortgage bonds to being one of the big people betting against them. And in fact, it's one of the acts that finally causes the market to crash. I think the analogy that came to mind when I was thinking about how this market finally does crash, it's a false market. It's being tethered down by the weight of all the Wall Street firms promoting it. And you sort of have like 10 or 12 big institutions holding onto ropes from a hot air balloon. They're holding it onto the ground, barely. The minute Goldman lets go, the balloon starts to rise off the ground. And another firm lets go, and it rises a little further and a little further. And finally, in the end, the balloon's up in the air, and there's six corpses on hanging from it. But Goldman just happened to be the first out.
So they got out just in time.
Yeah.
We're just a few seconds left here, but bottom line lessons learned here. Or are we still learning them? Or have we not learned them?
Well, it's just, there's so many conclusions to be drawn from a story like this, but the one thing that really interests me is the way it all comes back to human perception. It's like you have this drawing, and it looks like the face of a beautiful young woman in profile. 99% of human beings stare at the drawing and they see that. But 1% can see that it's also the face of a really ugly old witch staring straight at you. It's that one of those optical illusions. And why do people see the witch instead of the beautiful woman? That's the question.
Yep, and that's who you wrote about. His book is called The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. Michael Lewis, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Forum is produced by Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell, and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. I'm Scott Schaefer. And for Michael Krasny, thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.